Hi, my name's Izzy. Welcome to Lowercase Sober Part 2. If you're new to the podcast, I define lowercase sober personally as meaning I'm sober but not capital S sober. I don't drink, but I'm not in recovery or rehab in the traditional sense, and I'm not an addict. I think this distinction is super important, and I'll make it at the top of every episode. In part one of Lowercase Sober, I talked about my relationship to alcohol, especially being in my 20s. In part two, I'm interviewing other people about their relationship to alcohol. Each guest in part two was asked some of the questions I asked myself when I was developing part one, and I'm really excited to share their thoughts with you. This episode, our discussion is with someone who still drinks. We also discuss blacking out, so if that is a topic you are sensitive to, please use discretion when listening to this episode. A quick reminder, the podcast does have a Patreon where you can find fun perks like early access to episodes, all for the cost of a cup of coffee a month, or two or three. If you're interested in supporting the podcast, check it out at patreon.com/lowercasesober. Without further ado, our guest today is...
Hey guys, I'm Tyler. I go by he, him, his. I'm from East Brunswick, New Jersey. Recently lived in Brooklyn, New York, but back home due to the current circumstances, but... glad to be here. I am a copywriter, senior copywriter in the ad world, working in New York City.
What identifier do you use for your relationship with alcohol?
So currently I would say I'm a committed but conscious craft beer enthusiast. I think that's might be a little complicated at first to hear that, but in college I wasn't a huge drinker. I know I definitely partake from time to time, Friday, Saturday type thing. But, you know, I had friends that were out all the time, drinking all the time. And I definitely, had my ups and downs with that. But as I got older, you know, even more recently, I've just been more aware of, you know, how alcohol affects me, my actions because of it. And I just like myself a lot more when I drink, when I'm drinking responsibly and when I'm enjoying craft beer for the culture that surrounds it and the taste of the alcohol and not, you know, what it does to me and what it makes me feel like I'm able to do. So it's just, you know, it's a complicated relationship, but I definitely feel like a much better place now, especially, you know, being home, having, you know, access to alcohol so much more just because, you know, the state of, you know, what we're doing right now and how we work and, you know, weekends blending in with the week and not having to go in the office. So, you know, it's definitely interesting, but I feel a bit more of an adult when it comes to, or whatever that means, when it comes to my relationship with alcohol these days.
What was the last drink you had?
My last drink I had was actually last night. And it's funny because if this was like a month ago, right, I probably would have had like six beers because it was Saturday night, not doing anything. You know, I'm not really responsible for anything the next day. But last night I just had one beer. It's funny. I was actually FaceTiming with somebody, just having a conversation, you know, just casual chit chat, and, you know, and was able to just enjoy, a 12 ounce beer, something that I really enjoy, a sour beer, and let that be it. Right. I didn't have to go that extra mile to make myself feel a certain way, you know, because, you know, we're locked in, we're in quarantine and whatnot. So I've just, you know, been able to enjoy that. And I think that was a big, you know, a big step for me. I think my relationship with alcohol is sort of evolving right now with the sheer quantity. And so just one beer last night, and I didn't feel like I needed anything else. You know, I don't want to make excuses for myself based on the current global situation, but yeah, day by day.
The situation that we're in right now, I feel like a lot of people have been talking about either how they find themselves drinking more and more because, like you said, like the weekend and the week are kind of one big giant time frame. But it's interesting to also hear that you're finding that you're actually like becoming more aware of how much you're drinking and how it's affecting you.
100%. And I think I've made a very conscious choice about a month ago to really start taking care of my body and my mind a little bit better. You know, I'm definitely someone who struggles with their anxiety and confidence and just like self-image and stuff. And not a lot of people would know that because I don't really, you know, I try to put on my best happy face, you know, no matter what. But having this downtime, having this opportunity to reflect and just think about things holistically, you know, I've changed the way I've, you know, treated myself, just the way I've eaten and, you know, not drinking during the week, you know, so to speak, you know, saving if I do drink, you know, a Friday, Saturday type situation where for that, it's interesting because I feel like, oh, I have so much downtime now, I should just be drinking all the time. But because I have this opportunity to really make a change, how I feel physically and emotionally and mentally, not drinking during the week has been so beneficial and productive to that personal progress that I've, you know, been making.
we work in the same industry, and so you know that there it's a lot of like happy hours and
of course
and like
yeah.
company events and stuff like that. And not knocking it, but it's really easy when you're like at the office and people are inviting you out to happy hours to just be like, yeah, three drinks totally. On a Wednesday. Totally. Fine.
Not needed, but you just sort of go along with it because it's socially, you know, acceptable or, you know, encouraged, whatever that means.
And it's like a part of the culture in a way. What is your best memory associated with drinking?
I definitely have had a lot of, you know, fun around alcohol. And I think a lot of that fun has, for the most part, been done around drinking when I was still, you know, conscious and like there and totally with it. Yeah, feeling drunk, but I would never say, you know, my best nights were ever the nights when I blacked out ever. So I'd say, you know, just the parties in college were a lot of fun. But I would say like the core memory that I have was actually a little bit later in life. It was the first time I ever went to, you know, South by Southwest in Austin, Texas. It was my second time down in Austin. I went down with a buddy. He was, you know, thinking about looking, you know, for a new place to live. And we were like, this is a great time to go down and go to the parties and like check out the music and just all the cool things are happening, especially just being such a big music fan, like up and coming artists and whatnot. And it was actually St. Patty's Day when we were down there, and it was like March Madness basketball. There was people everywhere. It was just a lot going on. We were just drinking all day, but it was just spread out with water and different parties and walking and food. So I felt that, yeah, I probably had a couple, like too many calorie wise, but I felt like I had spread it out enough that I just felt good all day and had a great day until about 3:30 in the morning. We were heading back to someone's apartment, like four of us that we thought was one of our friends that we was with the whole night, and then the next morning we found out that actually no one knew them. So we had just stayed in this random guy's apartment, which was wild, but we almost got into a fight at a food truck with a group of guys. That's a whole other story, but that was pretty wild. But other than that, date was really great. And a lot of it had to do with just fun, casual drinking. But it was pretty awesome.
Yeah, there's something about day drinking when you have like a whole day of like activities planned.
Totally.
It's so,
yeah.
Like, it's so much different than like being at a party in one place and just like drinking and like getting kind of like stuck in whatever situation you're in. Some of my best memories are also like day drinking at like festivals and stuff like that.
Totally. It just a lot of it. I love the things that are associated with that rather than just the consumption itself. And I think that has steered my drinking to a different direction. Yeah. Being 21, I think that, you know, you have so much opportunity to do, you know, more things with alcohol, go more places where alcohol is available. So just that excitement around, you know, doing fun things, I think has given more purpose for you know, drinking, and it created more, you know, better memories than just say like, you know, a crazy night in college with your buddies or whatnot.
What is your funniest drinking story?
Totally. So there's one that stands out, and it's interesting because I wasn't really drinking that much, but I still had a couple of drinks that night. But I think it was just mostly because one of my friends was involved, and it was his 21st birthday, and I had turned 21 like 10 days maybe prior to his birthday. So I was home, and like my friends had lost him. He was like somewhere on campus, and he just showed up at my apartment, and I was like, hey, like I'll you know, I'm going to hold back names, obviously, of course, but you know, I was like, hey, what's going on? Like, how are you? How's your birthday night going? Whatnot. I had seen him earlier, and he was out and about, and he was walking around the living room, picking things up, just being like silly. And he saw a cardboard box that I don't know what it was for originally, but he saw it in the corner of like the room, and he started just like rambling how like he thought it was like a wooden chest that I had made in like wood shop in like the 8th grade. And he was like sort of making fun of it because it didn't look like it was made that well. And I couldn't help but laugh because I knew it was just like a cardboard box. And he proceeded to sit in it, like, or sit on it because he thought it was going to like support him. And he just like fell right through it. And he got stuck in the cardboard box and like couldn't get out for a good like 5 minutes. But I just like wouldn't help him because it was so funny. Like, it was just so funny and he couldn't stop laughing. But I think just enjoying that, knowing that he was safe, like around me, and I made sure he got home that night okay. And, you know, people showed up for him. I wasn't gonna, he tried to leave. And I was like, no, we're gonna stay here. But it was just a funny time to be around it. But yeah.
Now let's tone shift completely.
Ooh, yeah.
What is your worst memory associated with drinking?
So I'll definitely go into the one, you know, later, but this is a pretty recurrent memory that I have with every time I get to that point of a brownout or a blackout or to, you know, whatever, it gets hazy, whatever you want to call it, the amount of just anxiety and guilt that just comes from not remembering and being nervous about, what did I do? What did I say? Who did I come into contact with? You know, did I hurt anyone's feelings? Was I rude? Was I an idiot? Like, those things definitely spark in my conscious like that next morning, you know? So I definitely try to avoid that as best as I can and not put myself into those situations to recreate more memories like that, because yeah, has it happened a ton of times? No, but it's definitely happened. And I think, you know, back to it, and yeah, I'm regretful for those moments, but I also realize that, you know, I'm nowhere near perfect. You know, it happens once in a blue moon, no pun intended. But I try to, you know, use these new habits that I have with alcohol and, you know, not let myself get to that point where I'm creating these memories of, you know, of anxiety and, you know, why did I do that? So
that anxiety of like waking up the next morning and not like knowing exactly what had happened the night before. Like, even if I like browning out or just like the night moves so fast or whatever.
Right. Yeah.
That anxiety is, I think, like 80% of the reason. I mean, I also have like health stuff, but like 80% of the reason I stopped drinking was because of that. Because it was like so overwhelming to me to like not know if, like, I mean, my mind went as far as like, did I open that door weird? Are people going to talk about it the next day? Like, anxiety blade would like kick in so hard.
I totally echo that, because I've been in situations where I've just felt so bad, like to the point of like feeling sick inside, not from the alcohol. Yeah, I'm sure it didn't make it better, but, you know, genuinely got myself sick, because I know, like, in my heart, I would never do anything to hurt someone or, you know, do anything that would go against my core values and what I believe. But I just think that not knowing what happened, you just leave this space for the what if, you know, the uncertainty and lack of control for someone who struggles with anxiety is, you know, is such a, like, it's just so tough to deal with, not having, you know, your ducks in a row, so to speak, like of what happened, not being able to recall. And that's just, you know, that space that, being sober or not, I don't think anyone feels good, you know, in those scenarios. So,
scariest drinking story.
So this is going to be an interesting one, but it was actually the first time I ever got drunk, and I'll, you know, redact my age here, but I was at my university and was out with a friend at a, you know, at a party. And we were with people that were older than us. And, you know, we were, you know, excited to be there, excited that, you know, people wanted us at like an older party and whatnot. And, you know, we didn't bring any alcohol. We just had clueless. You know, people there were just like giving us stuff to drink and whatnot. And long story short, I guess we ended up blacking out, and we woke up in a hotel. We were supposed to be at the hotel, but we did not remember how we got there. And to be at this age and not understand what it's like to black out, to be belligerent, to get sick from alcohol was absolutely terrifying. I can't really describe the way I felt that next morning. You know, I was in tears just because I didn't understand what had happened. And eventually we pieced it all together, and, you know, nothing bad happened, you know, luckily. But I think from that moment, I was like, okay, this is real. Like, this is no joke. Like, this is what happens when you drink way, way too much. And I still to this day think that that was the worst I've ever felt after drinking, the most I had ever drank in one sitting. And just based on it being the first time I ever got drunk, was just such an eye-opening experience. But it was terrifying, absolutely terrifying, the first time I was like, alcohol decided, or I decided to drink alcohol, and then that alcohol decided to erase my memory entirely of that night. So yeah, hands down the scariest drinking story, and something I don't want to ever, you know, get back to again.
Yeah, that sounds terrifying.
Yeah, it was just how new alcohol was to us and not understanding what it could do. I was just completely at a loss, and it took me a really long time to drink alcohol again after that.
Yeah, I consider myself sort of lucky. I've only blacked out a few times.
Yeah.
And it was like much later in like my drinking life.
Yeah.
So it was like the last time I ever drank, I like, but like truly, truly blacked out. And then like a few times before that, but it was like been in the past like 4 years, not like when I was a wee baby child.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. There was a couple times in college, and there's been like maybe a handful of times post college, but like I've browned out a couple times where like things got hazy, yeah. But like, it's been a very long time since I like completely like was like walking around, bopping around to bars, like not remembering anything. Like that hasn't happened in a while.
You wrote, "Never really done anything that changed my life." Cool.
What's up? Yeah. Yeah, I have. Yeah, sorry about that.
Cool. Not everybody has. I literally keep that in there because it was just like the last time that I drank, well, I like changed everything about my life.
Right. It's interesting you say that. There was like one time, I'll never forget this. I had a college relationship. It was like the only person I ever really got serious with in college, just like one girl. And I'll never forget, we were watching, I was very, very drunk, and we were watching the Coachella live stream, and it was very late, right? Because over there, it's like midnight and it's still going on. It's like 2:33 in the morning here. And I was very, very drunk. And she wasn't my girlfriend yet, but it was pretty close. But the XX were playing, and there was like a very romantic, like love song on. And I like was dancing and like going up to the girl that I was with, and I pretty much like proclaimed my like love to her like through the XX song that was like on. So I guess that changed my life in the sense she became my girlfriend like very shortly after that because of the feels that I got from the wonderful XX duo, I mean trio, right? Just like listening to that, I forget what song it was, but I remember that candid, like very vividly that happened. It was like the first time I really told her that I cared about her. So I guess that changed my life because she became a big part of my life for a really long time. So there you go. I wish I remembered what song it was. I'm sure I could think of it, but maybe it was like Heart Skipped a Beat or something like that. But it was just one of their like super emotional, and I was just being sad boy Ty, but also thought I was like super suave and like cool.
Do you regret anything you've done while drunk?
Yeah, I think the easy answer, of course, is, you know, yes. Like, I think we would say, like, you know, texting someone you shouldn't have, you know, flirting with someone you maybe didn't really want to flirt with, right? Because, you know, whatever, alcohol took over and you had some confidence and you just felt alone or needed someone to be there to talk to. You know, being overly emotional, you know, done all that. So I think it's just regretting the times when I wasn't like the best version of myself. And I think it's fair to say that we always strive, or I try to strive to be, you know, the best version of myself. I come up short, obviously, being human. But in those moments, I would say majority of the time is when I'm furthest away from that, you know, best version of myself, when I've gotten to that point of being drunk and felt alone, you know, reached out to somebody that I maybe shouldn't have, or something, you know, something to that, you know, extent. But I think it's just regretting that, you know, I shouldn't have to go to somebody else to talk to someone to make me happy, or, you know, obviously you can talk to people to make you happy, but don't do it in a setting where like you're drunk and you feel bad or you feel sad or or you want to be like flirty or something like that, like you can, you'll feel so much better the next day if you, you know, once you're sober and you can talk to that person or to somebody that you genuinely really talk to, you know, with a clear mind and with, you know, with intentions that are truthful and fruitful and, you know, have your best interest in mind. And I think that's what I would say I regret the most is being in a situation where I'm not being my best self and, you know, and talking to somebody when I could just be, you know, with myself, gearing up for the next day to be back to where I should be, you know, being sober throughout the day and whatnot.
The idea of flirting with people that you don't really want to flirt with because you're like a few drinks in and you're just like, I just want somebody to like tell me I'm pretty or like nice or sweet or something. I feel that really hard. I feel like a lot of my, I'm not putting this in the podcast. A lot of my like list, you know, from my college years was like me having a few drinks and then like being like, I want a guy to tell me I'm like nice because I feel lonely right now. And that's such a cliche, but it's like kind of true. And then you end up like getting involved even in like a small way with people that you don't really care about.
Right, for sure. And it's, and I don't think it's done out of a bad intent or anything, but it's just, it just sort of happens and it's, you don't feel good about it, you know, after.
Yeah. And I think part of that's also, it's not just like alcohol, but I think it's also like, and this is like a whole other podcast, but like a hookup culture and.
Yeah, for sure. Which I don't really like to be a part of, you know, so yeah. I don't, and I never really found myself to be a part of that culture because it never made me feel good. So those definitely go hand in hand at some point for some people. But yeah, it's just not a fun feeling.
It's interesting as somebody who's like dating sober now, I guess. I feel like you, like I've lost a lot of those like kind of like when you stumble into something with someone.
Right.
You know, like those kind of relationships or like loose couplings.
Yeah, it's harder to come by when you're not in those alcohol related social situations where you might feel like it's easier to strike up a conversation that, you know, leads to, you know, more casual interactions with somebody rather than, you know, looking for more, you know, meaning out of a relationship right away. I mean, it's definitely different. And I think I've just found myself more drink, like when I am drinking less, like not during the week, you know, my conversations that I am having, you know, people that I, you know, am interested in or talking to or whatnot are more genuine, right? Like they're not, like they're more about getting to know the person and there's not as much focus on like that intimate side, I guess, that I'd rather build a relationship around, you know, someone becoming like my really good friend and then all those things follow suit. And I feel like a lot of times with alcohol, it's very easy for conversations to go that way of intimacy. Whether that's a bad thing or not is neither here nor there. But I know for me, I would, you know, like to build something based on just general connection and conversation and, you know, having things in common and you know, and growing there. And then that stuff, you know, the intimacy and whatnot comes, you know, with obviously over time.
For some relationships, there can be a too early moment. Like there can be a, like,
it has consequences for sure.
Yeah. And with some relationships that there is no too early moment. Like they're just, yeah. You can build them the other way too. Sex to like actual relationship built on like knowing each other. It's been an interesting, like, personal journey trying to like figure that out for myself and like figuring out what my like equation is, I guess.
Totally.
Like when now that I like don't have as much like hookup culture in my life and like bars and parties and stuff.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, I
works.
Totally agree. And I've definitely been in situations where both, you know, both situations have happened, right? Where things grew naturally or they didn't. So it both can work. I just know which one that I'd rather, you know, have happen. Yeah.
It's also nice knowing that. I don't really know what my thing is right now, but it's nice having that knowledge of like what you would like to build before you start building it.
Totally. And you just have that core base to yourself, and you know what you deserve and you know what you want. Yeah. And if you encounter something that feels way off course, right, or what feels way different than when you're not, you're able to identify that right away and either slow things down or be upfront with that person. Yeah. And level with them as far as what you're looking for, and you know, and move forward with them or without them.
Yeah. I've been talking to a lot of people who also started dating people right before this like really weird time started. And they all have similar things where they're either like, we decided to just jump in with both feet. Now we're like in a full fledged long distance relationship with each other, despite only starting to date in like 2 months ago.
I've had interesting situations, not like situations, but just like interactions since this whole thing. Like, I was talking to someone for a little while, and then this whole situation pretty much like pulled us apart just because of like being long distance and like realizing what our committed nature was to it.
Yeah.
And then just like being on dating apps and stuff, I try to be upfront, just be like, listen, like I would love to, you know, grow and build something, you know, from afar. And then when things get a little bit better, you know, meet up and whatnot. But it's hard, especially like when you're trying to focus on yourself and be happy and content through all of this and, you know, be strong for yourself and your family. It's tough to like at the same time build something with somebody like that. You yeah. can't hold their hand and you can't make lunch with or go for a walk with or kiss or any of that. Like, it's just so, it feels unnatural, but it's just sort of the reality of
it. Yeah, there's also like how much energy can you put into something new and building something new when like the world and everyone around you is like, I mean, like the situation at hand itself is like eating up most of your energy every day.
Yeah, 100%.
Tough times we're in right now.
Truly, truly.
I have friends who have started, like, weirdly started relationships too during right. this time, like not with people that they didn't know beforehand. And I don't know. It's weird. I'm so bad at like dating apps and stuff like that.
Right.
That
yeah.
When people are like, oh, well, you can just like go on a dating app and like talk to people and then meet up with them when things are good. Like you are talking about.
Right.
I'm literally like, oh no, that's the one form of dating I'm the worst at. That
yeah. Well, and right, now. Right. Well, it is our only option. Yeah. It's just, even if someone was like, hey, Izzy, I'd love to set you up with my friend, you would be like, great. That's the equivalent of just meeting somebody on a dating app right now. Yep. Like, because all I can do is talk to your friend, and then, you know, that's all we have. So,
yeah. It's wild.
Yeah.
Also, it's really weird that I'm like a writer and I do all this like media stuff and dating apps are like my downfall.
Like, but I think it's just an entirely different outlet. Like entirely different medium. Like there's so many variables and you meet so many different personalities and
yeah,
it's just you meet so many different types of effort levels too. It like there's never a consistent, like, I mean, so people are so different, but like it's just funny how it all boils down to.
Okay, here's my thing with dating apps. The level of consistent effort problem is usually like my fault.
Right.
Where I'm like, oh no, I like don't care enough to keep talking to you. Oh no. Oh no.
Yeah. Yeah. And then before you know it, you're just like, well, that person just disappeared because I just like stopped responding.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it happens. Or you're talking to like three people and you're like, where do we go from? Like, do I just start talking to one of you more? Like, yeah. I can't go see you. Like, I can't. Like, naturally, you would be like talking to a couple people. One person would stand out. You would meet them. You're like, okay, I'm going to focus on this person. Like, how do you even make that distinction right now? Do you just, yeah. you just be like, hey, person, I'm going to delete the dating app stuff and maybe we can just be the only people texting right now. Like, it's just, how do you even go about that?
Ooh, I'm like not on the app, so I didn't even think about that. That's such a dilemma of like, how do you sort through? Because it is so natural to just be like, I pick you. what do you do to stay safe drinking?
So I think safety for me a lot of the time has to do with attempting to, you know, stay in control, which for me is just limiting alcohol. And, you know, I'm definitely a proponent of drinking water. Genuinely, for the most part, I stay away from shots. I've just never been a fan of just like getting that drunk that quickly. Like, I do like to just sit and sip on a beer and just like really enjoy what it, you know, what it tastes like. And that helps me, you know, space things out better and like, you know, limit myself, you know, because beer is just heavier and, you know, and it's easier drinking as opposed to like liquor, in my opinion, at least. Like, I'm not throwing shots back. I do like an occasional like cocktail, like a cool cocktail bar, but I'll never buy a bottle of hard liquor and like make cocktails. That's just like not in my nature. Unless someone was like, hey, let's do like Mars. And I might be like, all right, like whatever, we'll do like a margarita night or something. But that's just not what I do. So for me, it's definitely just, you know, doing my best to, you know, enjoy water, take my time, you know, limit the number of drinks. And I do decently well at that. But after a certain point, that control turns into that like invincibility. Like, oh, I'm just going to have another one. I'm home. I'm not going to go anywhere. I'm not going to drive anywhere. Doesn't mean you're not going to black out in your own house. So it's like, it's just, you know, watching yourself, right? Making sure that, you know, you're drinking the amount that you know you can handle. And at the end of the day, doing those things, being safe like that, for me, leads to a better night, you know, a more comfortable night and not feeling like, you know, a bad person in the morning or, you know, that I made a mistake by drinking too much.
Thank you so much, Ty.
Of course, Izzy. Thanks for having me on. It's good to hear from other people's perspectives and knowing that we're all human and we all, you know, are on our own personal journeys and, you know, finding out what works best for us. And I wish everyone listening to this and everyone who's going to be on this podcast, you know, all the best in their, you know, their journey. You know, hopefully it, you know, takes you where you want it to.
Thank you again to Ty for a great conversation. Okay, now for our weekly educational segment. I feel like this needs its own theme music. But anyway, this week we're going to talk about the war on drugs. There's a really good video that I'm going to link in the description of this episode that features Jay-Z and illustrator Molly Crabapple. It came out in 2016, but it's a great primer on the background of the war on drugs and how we got to where we are right now, with white people disproportionately profiting off of the marijuana industry while Black and Latinx people disproportionately still sit in prison and jail for low-level drug offenses such as possession. Since that video came out, even more states have legalized marijuana to different degrees. But again, I'll link it in the description just because it's a good basic digestible overview in less than 4 minutes. But here are the basic facts of the war on drugs. Most drug laws and classifications in the United States are based on racism and discrimination. Anti-opium laws were directed at Chinese immigrants as a way to crack down on establishments that catered to them. Anti-cocaine laws were directed originally at Black men in the South. Anti-marijuana laws began as an attempt to control and push out Mexican migrants and Mexican Americans, despite marijuana being a medicinal plant. Those laws, which originated around the turn of the 20th century, became so firmly baked into the American legal system that you can trace their origins directly to how our current prison system operates. After drugs became a symbol of rebellion, dissent, and political activism in the 1960s, Nixon declared a war on drugs in the 1970s. Nixon declared in a White House briefing speech, "America's public enemy number one in the United States is drug abuse. In order to fight and defeat this enemy, it is necessary to wage a new all-out offensive." That meant federal investigations, the introduction of no-knock warrants, mandatory sentencing. John Ehrlichman, a top Nixon aide, later admitted the following allegedly. There's some sort of dispute about whether or not he actually said this, but allegedly he said, "The Nixon White House after that had two enemies, the anti-war left and Black people. You understand what I'm saying? We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or Black, but by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and Blacks with heroin, and then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt those communities," end quote. Phew, okay, let's now take a good hard look at the results of this war on drugs in New York State, the Rockefeller drug laws. These are a good set of laws to look at because not only did they do devastating things to citizens in New York, but they also inspired other states to follow suit, leading to decades of rising prison population numbers. Named after Nelson Rockefeller, who was New York's governor at the time, the Rockefeller drug laws introduced mandatory minimum sentences for drug charges, 15 years for possession of 4 ounces or more of heroin, morphine, opium, cocaine, or cannabis, or selling 2 ounces or more. And they were, plot twist here, opposed by many, including highly conservative lawmakers and law enforcement and civil rights groups for their draconian conflation of low-level offenses with murder, which civil rights groups argued correctly would unfairly target low-income Black communities. And they were right. They were right about that. Many attribute the rising prison populations in New York and across the United States since the 70s with the Rockefeller laws and how they contributed to legislation and law enforcement across the country. There is no evidence that the Rockefeller drug laws positively affected any communities and were criticized as being inefficient and disruptive. New York Governor George Pataki signed the Drug Law Reform Act into law in 2004, replacing the indeterminate sentencing under the Rockefeller drug laws with a determinate system. It also reduced minimum sentences for serious offenses and increased the weight of a substance required for a serious possession charge, therefore making the laws apply to less people. In 2009, mandatory minimum sentences were removed from the New York Penal Law and New York Criminal Procedure Law, meaning judges could sentence defendants to shorter sentences or alternative sentences, including drug treatment or probation. The legacy of these laws and the war on drugs can be seen in low-income and minority neighborhoods. It can be seen in the persistence of lawmakers to continue stop and frisk in New York City. It can be seen in the increase of young Black men being arrested for marijuana possession, despite simple possession of marijuana being decriminalized in New York. It can be seen in the frequency with which police departments across the United States rely on simple drug charges to put people behind bars. That legacy can also be seen in how we view drug and alcohol treatment in the United States, with shame, with secrecy, and filled with white people. Drug abuse is a health crisis in America, not a criminal one. There are thousands of people either in prison or in a cycle of recidivism and poverty because of the Rockefeller drug laws. If we're going to talk about the decriminalization of controlled substances in the United States, we have to talk about getting those people out of prison, breaking those cycles, and abolishing the systems that put them there. There's not really an action item today other than I just hope that you'll read more about the Rockefeller drug laws, their legacy, and the war on drugs. If you like the podcast and want to throw a few dollars a month my way to support the project, I'd really appreciate it. The perks of becoming a Patreon supporter are great and include things like exclusive episodes, input on future topics, and access to the Lowercase Sober Discord server. Again, you can find my Patreon at patreon.com/lowercaseover. Thanks for listening. My name's Izzy D'Esposito. I record, edit, and produce this podcast. If you want to follow us on social media, you can find the podcast on Instagram at lowercasesober. Resources are in the description if you or a loved one is struggling with alcohol dependence. Sending lots of love. Finally, a big shout out to our Patreon supporters, Sarah, Mo, Allie, Taylor, and Allie. Thank you so much for your support. If you want to join them and get a shout out at the end of every Lowercase Sober episode, you can do so by going to patreon.com/lowercasesober and choosing the tier that works best for you. And stay safe.